Counsel?
May it please the court, my name is Cynthia Kagiwada, and I'm representing appellant Glenn Keokapu Jr. in his appeal. As I noted in my briefs, there's really two trials that happened below. There was the guilt phase of the trial, and then there was also the extended term jury trial on sentencing. And this was, I believe, one of the first cases to go all the way through an extended term jury trial. And I believe part of the problem below with the sentencing trial is I'm not sure that the court focused or helped the parties to focus on the two things they needed to find. Really, the only two things they needed to find was whether or not Mr. Keokapu had two or more felonies. And then the second thing was whether or not an extended term was necessary for public protection. And as I noted in my briefs, I believe that there are some issues that extended way beyond those two narrow issues. And then the second set of issues concerns the guilt phase of the trial, mainly having to do with pretrial publicity and the pretrial publicity statement. But I would like to start, if I can, first with the sentencing issues, because there's more of those. In this case, there really wasn't any dispute about whether or not Mr. Keokapu had two or more prior felonies. So the real focus of the sentencing trial was on whether or not his extended term was necessary for the protection of the public. And as such, all mitigating and aggravating factors are important. Therefore, there were some problems with some of the witnesses who testified, and that's why everything that the witnesses testified to becomes very important. The first witness was, at the time, Mr. Keohokapu's wife, Kawalani Keohokapu, and she testified regarding three incidents that had occurred prior to the offense. The first one that she testified about that was problematic occurred on April 3rd, 1996. And the record is somewhat unclear. However, Ms. Keohokapu indicated that the prosecuting attorney gave her police reports in the hallway. And then as she had problems remembering what had happened, and so the prosecutor tried to refresh her memory with the police report. There's no indication, however, that the prosecutor retrieved the police report from her before she started asking her questions. And indeed, during her subsequent testimony, Kawalani stated that on the paper it says he slapped me. And then the prosecutor also continued to ask, well, what was written in the statement? At least three questions from the prosecutor were directed to what was written rather than to Kawalani's refreshed recollection. Now, it does not appear that the defense counsel specifically objected to that particular incident, but later, as the testimony went on, Kawalani went on to testify about two more incidents. With respect to something that happened on July 13th, 1996, she actually indicated that she was reading from the police report, and that was improper in terms of recollection refreshed, because she obviously was not testifying from a refreshed memory, but from something she was reading from in front of her. Now, the prosecutor tried to correct things later and tried to introduce it then as past recollection recorded. However, by that time, she had already testified improperly by reading from the paper, so you can't unring the bell once she's already testified improperly. So even if that subsequent attempt to bring it in as past recollection recorded would have normally been proper, it wasn't under this circumstance. And then the final incident that Kawalani testified to occurred on October 20th, 1994, and as even the prosecutor has conceded, it was error for her to testify because she did indeed, again, indicate she was reading from a report. The state, in its answering brief, argued that the court's failure to strike this testimony was an oversight. But again, I would direct the court to the problem with this being extended term jury trial, whether or not there were sufficient aggravating factors that would have caused the jury to find that an extended term was necessary for the public protection. You know, it can't be just harmless error because everything counts. Does the court have any questions on that first witness's testimony? Okay. And then there was another witness who testified, Mr. Balga, and he clearly indicated that he could not remember what had happened back in, I can't remember how long ago it was, but it was quite a while back. And so the prosecutor attempted to refresh his memory. It didn't work. And so then the prosecutor tried to introduce his statement as past recollection recorded. However, Mr. Balga indicated that he was a heavy drinker at the time, and he had no recollection of the event. And so given the heavy drinking that he was undergoing at the time, there's no showing that he adopted or made that statement at the time. He had no memory of that event. Even if the prosecutor could have gotten that in as proper past recollection recorded, we would note that the prosecutor was having some difficulty laying the foundation for this. And at sidebar, the circuit court appeared to be coaching the prosecutor, advising the prosecutor to take a look at Rule 802.1 and ask the prosecutor to think about what rule she was using. And so that was improper as well. Moving on to other errors that happened at the sentencing trial, I believe the prosecutor lost focus again when, in rebuttal of the closing argument, the prosecutor stated, "I asked you, what chance does Stephen have in life?" Stephen being the decedent. Again, this is not proper comment, given that the focus was on whether or not Mr. Keohokapu had two or more prior felonies, or whether his extended term was necessary for the protection of the public.
Was there an objection to that?
There was not. Yeah, so it would be prosecutorial misconduct. And then the final thing that occurred at the sentencing trial was regarding the jury instructions, and this was objected to. The proposed jury instructions included instructions on the function of the Hawaii Paroling Authority and whether or not how the Hawaii Paroling Authority does its job. Again, this is irrelevant. Whether or not Mr. Keohokapu would have been subjected to parole later has nothing to do with the issue at hand, whether or not his extended term was necessary for the protection of the public.
If it was not relevant, was it harmless?
No, because I believe what it does is it tends to suggest to the jury that if they give him a shorter sentence and don't convict him on the extended term, that he may get out earlier because the paroling authority is going to set a mandatory minimum. And so therefore, he may not serve the entire 20 years for the manslaughter conviction he was facing. So no, I don't think it could be harmless error.
But it was not an incorrect statement, was it?
Incorrect statement of the Hawaiian parole? No, but it was misleading and confusing because it tended to direct...
If it was a correct statement of the law, how is it misleading?
Well, it's misleading because it was not relevant to what this particular jury was having to decide. You know, this jury, you know, whether or not the paroling authority is going to set the mandatory minimum term of imprisonment at some later date is not relevant to whether or not the extended term was necessary for the protection of the public. You know, that, and the danger there is in swaying the jury to think about what might happen later down the road, which is not what their function was at this point. Are there any questions from the court on anything else that happened in the extended term sentencing trial? Okay. Moving on to the issues that I raised concerning the guilt phase of the trial, the main issue concerns whether or not there was improper pretrial publicity, which affected the jurors, and then specifically whether or not the pretrial publicity statement that the circuit judge provided to the entire veneer was proper. And just to refresh the panel's recollection, the problem with this pretrial publicity statement is in it, the court instructed the veneer that the decedent was reported in the media as being a good Samaritan. Now, to point out a couple of procedural problems, there's no record of when this pretrial publicity statement was arrived at. Mr. Keoho Kapu was not present when this statement was discussed. There's clearly, you know, there's no record at all of how this came to be. It was just presented for the first time at jury selection, and the court used it again and again in going through individual voir dire.
Was there an objection at any point in time when it was read?
No, there was not. However, I would note again, as the state has said, well, this should be plain error then because there was no objection. However, again, since there's no record of when the statement was formulated, and Mr. Keoho Kapu wasn't present, and he, you know, this is not part of the record, obviously, he was first presented with it at jury selection, you know, that was the first time he even heard about it.
But it was read a number of times.
Number of times, because the court did do individual voir dire over, I believe it was 6 days, and each time the court brought in a new part of the veneer for jury selection, the judge read that statement over. And so it was, you know, read several times. And then the problem with this statement is I think it compounded the problem of 8 out of the 12 jurors who actually ended up serving indicated that they had heard about the case beforehand. And of those 8, 5 of them at least had either remembered that the decedent had been referred to as a Good Samaritan or that he was an intervener in a dispute, which is essentially a description of a Good Samaritan. And the defense did object, you know, several times to the seating of these jurors. Given the high number of jurors who were exposed to the pretrial publicity, that compounded with the statement being kind of forced in there about him being a possible Good Samaritan, you know, caused error at the trial level.
Was there any evidence as to the extent of the pretrial publicity, other than the discussion with the jurors, who some who had heard more than others, some who recalled more than others? But
I know through, like I said, there were several days of jury selection, and I know through the selection it came out that it had been reported in the papers and also, I believe, on most of the news stations. I can look that up for the panel if you'd like, but I know it was through the voir dire that occurred, it was several, you know, it wasn't just like one incident. It was all over the place. So.
Basically, Judge Crandall really spent a lot of time trying to ensure there was a fair and impartial jury, didn't she?
She did do an extensive jury selection. Yes, that is true. However, you know, I do note that, again, 8 of the 12 jurors were exposed to this pretrial publicity, and the effect of the pretrial publicity statement in particular was never really addressed, how that affected them in addition to their own exposure to the media.
There's no challenge, though, to the representation or the fact, I suppose, that each of the jurors who served that were exposed, each of them said that they could be fair and impartial and that that media reports could be inaccurate. Each of them did.
I don't know specifically if each of them, I know that, yes, she did inquire about whether they could be fair and accurate. I don't know if they, each particular juror who sat, if they said they could set aside their media accounts.
I mean, that's not challenged anywhere in the brief sentence, so, I mean, there's nothing that the defense has pointed to challenging that.
Well, the defense, you know, did object over and over again, though, to the seating of these jurors, saying, how can it possibly be a fair trial when you have such a large number of these jurors being seated? And I believe, you know, there's a case that I cited in my briefs that even if people indicate that they're going to be fair and impartial, you know, that's not always the case. I mean, of course they're going to say that. But yes, that is correct. Are there any further questions at this time?
No.
Okay, then I'd like to save the remaining of my time for rebuttal if I could.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, James Anderson for the state. I'm gonna start with your permission with the pretrial publicity issue. First of all, that's divided into two segments, presumed prejudice and actual prejudice, as far as my research shows. Here, there is no factual basis to presume prejudice. Looking at the three Ainsworth factors, there is no indication there is extensive pretrial publicity at all. There is no evidence that the media accounts were primarily factual versus inflammatory. And, of course, a description of the victim as being a good Samaritan would never be admissible at trial. In fact, it was quite to the contrary. He started the fight. But what we are certain of is that there is no actual prejudice. The court scrupulously voir dired those people who had heard, those jurors who had heard of the case, and excused those who could not set aside their preconceived notions with cause. And all the jurors that defendant takes exception to, my understanding of the evidence is only three people understood, had heard that the victim was a good Samaritan. But in the end, the jurors all said that they would decide the case on the evidence, they would remain free and fair and impartial, and agreed that the media reports might necessarily be accurate. Defendant apparently thought this was the case because he did not even utilize his 10th, 11th, and 12th peremptory challenges, which is a factor this court should consider. As to the veneer being tainted by the entire veneer being tainted by the pretrial publicity statement, well, they have to hear what it is in the first place. But and the law does not require that jurors be completely ignorant of the facts of the case. What it does require is that the jurors set aside any preconceived notion, decide the case on the evidence, and be fair and impartial. And there's nothing to indicate otherwise in this case.
Mr. Anderson, what was the extent of the record below in terms of the exposure in the media?
There was none, Your Honor, aside from the judge's only her own publicity statement, the one that was formulated.
And based on the questioning with each of the jurors?
Yes, they had heard it either on the news or in the paper. I think one or the other, right. Turning to the sentencing phase of the trial, there were three incidents that were at issue here. The April 3rd incident where Kawi was separated from defendant and went to get her things from her apartment, and defendant slapped her, grabbed her neck, and threatened to kill her. The progression is important here. Kawi was refreshed with that statement. That is not problematic at all. July 13, 1996 statement, defendant visited Kawi, who was staying at her mom's friend's house. They argued, he pulled her hair, headbutted her, bit her in the eye and shoulder, and grabbed her by the ears. It seemed like everything was progressing smoothly at that point. But when Kawi started talking about the October 20th, 1994 incident, defense counsel noticed that she was reading from her 252, not a police report, her 252. And in abundance of caution, counsel went back and refreshed Kawi as to the July incident. And she said she was refreshed in most part except for the headbutting and the hair pulling. Prosecutor did not go into the October 20th incident at all. And that should have been stricken, and I agree. But even if, and I put it to you, even if the July 13th and October 20th incidents were improperly received, given the plethora of evidence of the domestic violence between these two, which was competently entered into evidence, given his extensive criminality, it was entirely harmless. There's no way that the jury could not decide that his criminality was extensive. As far as the past recollection recorded, you have to show that the statement that the witness no longer remembers was made by the witness and at the time of the incident. At the time of the incident means it was fresh in the memory. Those are the circumstances that are relevant here. You don't need that talismanic thing, yes, it was fresh in my mind. That's ridiculous. I don't think anyone could say that it was fresh in my mind. They identify, it was their handwriting, their signature, their date of birth, social security number, phone number, and the date of the incident. Kawi even said that she recalled going the next day after the incident with her mother to the police station. So there are substantial indications of trustworthiness in this past recollection record that was read in. The misconduct. Well, initially, in its initial closing argument, the prosecutor did state you have to find two felonies committed after the age of 18, and you have to find that the extended term is necessary for the protection of the public. I think she was on one of those topics in rebuttal when defendant objected and said, no, there's two elements. Well, it was overruled because she had already said there are two elements. That's non-problematic at all. As far as the prosecutor's remark, this is how it developed. In closing, the defense blamed defendant's criminality on his father's beatings and his father's testimony. He had his father come up and testify, beat him so bad, I don't think the kid had a chance in life. The defense used that to inflame the jury, to garner the sympathy of the jury. That's the only intent of that, obviously. And the prosecutor, in response, in rebuttal, said, now listen, it's natural that you feel sympathy for this guy, but you're going to receive an instruction that says that's not part of your decision making. And then retorted, you know, he said, what chance does Glenn have in life? I ask you, what chance does Stephen have in life? Now, this is, if this were in the regular phase of trial, without defendant's, you know, remark first, it could be problematic. This is at the sentencing phase in trial. The jury has already found that Wilcox was not fairly killed. This was not a fair fight. This guy stabbed him when they were fighting. So, in that sense, it was not misconduct. Secondly, Clark, those cases cited in Clark, and I can't remember the one right now, states that where an improper attempt or remarks to, if you provoke or invite a rhetorical remark such as that was elicited here by a prosecutor, you can't complain of prejudice later at all. Okay. Finally, the HBA parole instructions. The ones at issue are the HBA shall fix the minimum term of imprisonment which must be served before the principal is eligible for parole. And then instruction 4, no parole will be granted unless the HPA believes prisoner will not re-violate and his release is not incompatible with the welfare and safety of society. This would certainly not urge the jury to give a life term as opposed to a 20-year term or deny eligibility for extended term imprisonment. This was basically, I would say, informative. The way it was the instructions progressed, the court defined the maximum indeterminate term for his manslaughter conviction, the two elements required for the extended term. The extended term would extend the 20-year term to life imprisonment with the possibility of parole, and subject to the minimum term set by the HPA. The HPA had the discretion not to consider parole unless he has a record of exemplary behavior, and had the discretion to reduce a minimum term, and then define parole, and then instruction number 4, that it shall not be granted unless HBA believes a prisoner will not re-violate, and it's not his release is not incompatible with welfare and of society.
Well, Ms. Kagiwara argues that, number one, it's irrelevant, the instruction is irrelevant, and number two, it's not harmless. Can you address that?
Well, I would say at least it's not prejudicially inconsistent, erroneous, misleading. I would say that at least, because it's more neutral, just informative as to, because, you know, I guess the court felt that if it's going to define the term, what an indeterminate term was, and on, it was just going to include the whole process of how a person would get sentenced. But to that extent, it surely doesn't raise the specters in the case that the defense cites, the Rose instruction, where you know, good conduct could earn time off a sentence by, you know, you're not even eligible for parole until one-third of your sentence or 20 years has passed. All these, the prosecutor advised the jury that he would be eligible for parole after serving one-third of his sentence. The court advisement that he would necessarily serve the maximum sentence. None of this stuff occurred here. The jury didn't know what the minimum term was, and only that the parole board would set it.
You think it could have confused the jury?
I don't think so at all. It was just so blandly informative. I don't think it was prejudicial in the slightest.
Necessary instruction to be given?
You know, I don't know that. I don't know that yet. I cannot answer that, Your Honor. Because these are so fresh, these extended term sentencing here, the penalty phases in Hawaii. I don't know what's going to be required on this one. But as it is, I don't think it's prejudicial. I think it was just, if at best, irrelevant and unnecessary. But not misleading and not erroneous, certainly, because they're accurate based upon the statutes. So I ask that you affirm, Your Honor. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
If I could, at first, I just wanted to address some of the questions regarding the pretrial publicity statement. In terms of the extensiveness of the publicity, on page 3 of my reply brief, I noted that this was reported in the Honolulu Advertiser, KSSK radio station, Channel 2, Channel 6, Channel 7, and Channel 8. So that was kind of, and that came out from the individual voir dire of the jurors. And then in terms of what the individual jurors remembered and what they said in terms of their ability to be fair or impartial, some of them were a little more equivocal than others. And this, again, is on page 4 through 5 of my reply brief. One of the jurors, Juror Padilla, said he was somewhat equivocal about whether he could be fair and impartial. When asked if he could be fair and impartial, he said, yeah, I guess so, and I guess. Another juror, Goshert, said he could be fair and impartial, but he remembered the part about the decedent intervening in a domestic dispute. And then Juror Bagoyo was also somewhat equivocal about his impartiality. At one point, he said he could be fair and impartial, but when asked if he could set aside what he heard in the news, he said, I think I can do that. Another juror, Honda, said he could be fair and impartial, but again, he remembered that the decedent had been described as a good Samaritan and that he had intervened in a domestic argument. And then Juror Gaina, same thing, said he could be fair and impartial, but he also recalled the Good Samaritan comment. And then he elaborated, he said what he remembered was, what I think I recall is something about somebody trying to help or something, and they got stabbed, and, well, I felt sorry for the guy because he's a Good Samaritan and trying to help out.
Now, these jurors weren't challenged, were they?
They were challenged overall, and... You know, I don't recollect at this particular point, but I'm guessing not. I believe that the defense counsel made a blanket objection to anyone who had been exposed, and he tried to make that objection more than once. But I don't believe...
You're arguing the individual juror shouldn't have been sat. Certainly counsel should have objected to that jury from being sat.
Well, even if he hadn't objected, it would be plain error, I think, not to... given some of the statement, like the last one that I just read, that he obviously indicated some kind of sympathy for the decedent. Okay, I think that was all on those individual jurors. And I know that the state has indicated that they think only 3 people remembered the Good Samaritan comment, but again, 8 of the people who were seated remembered something about the case, and of those 8, 5 of them remembered either Good Samaritan or being an intervener in a dispute. And then to address the state's argument that because not all the peremptories were used, the Pauline case actually stated just because defense counsel didn't exercise all of their peremptories does not necessarily mean that there wasn't a problem. They may have just chosen to stick with the jury that they had rather than risk going to some other jurors. Turning to the sentencing issues, well, did the court have any questions about the publicity statement? Okay. Turning to the sentencing issues, I would disagree with the prosecutor's, the state's characterization that the April 3rd, 1996 was merely a refreshed recollection because Kawalani indicated that it said here on the paper that she had been slapped, and the prosecutor even asked her, you know, well, what did you say in your written statement? So I don't believe that she was just testifying from her refreshed recollection. And then with the July 13th, 1996 one, again, she had trouble with her memory being refreshed, and again, she had already read from the statement. So it's not okay after she's already read from the statement then to try to get it in as past recollection recorded. And then as I indicated in the beginning, I don't think you can say that letting something in, such as the October 20th, 1994 statement, is harmless error, because in this particular case, we're looking at aggravating factors, mitigating factors, which might have caused the jury to determine that it was necessary for the public protection to impose the extended term. So it's not just, you know, I think everything is for consideration before the jury. And then I'm not sure if I understood correctly, because I didn't understand whether the state was addressing Mr. Balga's testimony when he indicated the only thing you need to have is at the time of the incident for past recollection recorded that it was fresh in that person's mind. And, you know, we would agree with that statement. But again, I think the problem is Mr. Balga indicated he was a heavy drinker at the time. And, you know, my argument was that there's no indication that he remembered at the time that he made that statement. Yes, he identified his signature and the date, but he had absolutely no recollection of making that statement. And given his huge drinking problem, you know, did he indeed adopt or make that statement? Turning to the prosecutorial misconduct and the rebuttal, first of all, Mr. Keohokapu wasn't blaming his father's beatings for his situation, but again, this was a mitigating factor that the jury was entitled to consider in determining whether or not his extended term was necessary for the protection of the public. So it wasn't so much trying to elicit sympathy for Mr. Keohokapu as providing background on his situation and why he may or may not, you know, need an extended term. And even if, you know, given what was said in closing argument by the defense, it still does not justify the prosecutor bringing in the decedent when this was not what was at issue in the extended term trial. You know, maybe it would have been brought up in the guilt phase of the trial, but as far as sentencing goes, the decedent and, you know, what happened to him had no impact on what the jury was considering, whether or not it was necessary for the protection of the public. In terms of the jury instruction, you know, the state has argued that this was a neutral instruction, so why include it? I mean, why give this instruction and lead the jury to speculate about what the paroling authority is going to do?
Isn't, though, somewhat of a new process in Hawaii where we're having the jury make these determinations as opposed to a judge?
It is, and that's actually why I requested oral argument, because I think it's important to try to, you know, help the jury to focus on what they need to do. And in terms of what the paroling authority is going to do or what they're going to do when they set a mandatory minimum term, that has nothing to do with whether or not extended term is necessary for public protection. And so I do believe it is misleading and prejudicial, because it allows the jury to speculate, you know, why are they being instructed about Hawaii paroling authority? The court must want us to think about it. I mean, why is it there otherwise in the instructions? Does the panel have any further questions for me? Okay. So in conclusion, we would request that the court remand at least for a new sentencing trial, and if not, for a new guilt phase trial as well. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court will take the matter under advisement.